miles of black ribbon on the lone highway. Men turned into boys on the lone highway. Dressed up creeps fly on the lone highway. Pretty girls beware out on the lone highway. On the lone highway. Revolution Radio, it's Saturday, and it's time for the Scorpio Conspiracy Show with your host, Scorpio. Lost a little honey on the lone highway.
Let me pour another. Hello, and welcome to the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, soon to be renamed Operation Scorpio. Today's date is Saturday, August 15th, 2020, and welcome to the free-range open-air insane asylum we call Earth. Yes, the smell of tyranny is in the air, an odor so strong you can smell it through your mask, your soon-to-be mandated mask, if the lunatics running the asylum have their way. It should be increasingly obvious to everyone listening to the sound of my voice that we are experiencing an economic event much more so than a medical event. Or let's just say that the medical event is being used as a cover to bring the economy as we know it to a virtual standstill. Yes, Operation Corona is without a doubt the biggest mass mind control event any one of us has ever lived through. And you can rest assured that a committee of psychologists were consulted and participated in the planning and execution of Operation Corona. Human behavior and how to control it has been under the microscope for over 100 years. Well, actually a lot longer than that. But since the dawn of the 20th century, it has been examined scientifically to an ever-increasing degree. And now, through the use of technology, our controllers now have the ability to apply such control on a mass scale. And the use of psychology to engineer and control society will be discussed thoroughly later today in the show. But anyway, here we have Operation Corona, the magic virus that can morph itself to cause any medical symptom known to man. Yes, every malady ever inflicted upon the human race has now been conveniently placed under the umbrella of COVID. Everything from a bad case of the sniffles to itchy eyes, stomach maladies, and heart disease, and now hair loss. Yes, hair loss has been deemed a symptom or after effect of COVID. Yes, hair loss. Who knew, huh? And what's the next symptom for COVID? Athlete's foot, maybe? You know, I don't know. That's coming next, probably. But COVID is magical in ways that go far beyond the ever-increasing list of symptoms and after effects that seem to grow by the day. COVID is also magical in the sense that it can fulfill every dream on the wish list of the New World Order conspirators. Conspirators whose goal it is to control every square inch of the planet and every human being who lives on it. Yes, COVID is preventing most people from doing unnecessary traveling. People, you know, only go to the store now to buy the essentials before returning home. You know, going to work and sending your kids off to school is either very difficult or impossible now. Say hello to a much smaller carbon footprint, guys. Yes, the climate change agenda is being miraculously fulfilled by COVID, the magic virus. But wait, there's more. That's just one item on the wish list that COVID is providing the conspirators. Social distancing and restrictions on social gatherings is preventing people from open discussion and exchange of ideas in public. After all, if too many people get together, uncomfortable questions about what is happening might be asked. And even more dangerous, uncomfortable answers and conclusions might be drawn. There's that corona magic working again, guys. Oh, yeah. And of course, it's been a well-known fact to our controllers for at least a century that a population who is terrified and kept in a state of fear is much more malleable and easier to control. I'm sure they've known that for a lot more than a century, but let's just say a century for sure. A terrified population will be willing to accept restrictions on their lives that they would never have accepted under normal circumstances. The willingness to flush Western society down the toilet and to give away the very things that are the most important to us as individuals and human beings has never been greater. All because of fear. Yes, that magic corona working its magic again, right? And those are just a few things that corona, the magic virus, is providing the conspirators. And, you know, probably the most important aspect of this whole thing, this Operation Corona, is it is essentially shutting down the economy and people's lives unlike anything that would have ever been thought possible just 6 months ago, right? I mean, who would have thought that the economy would just come to a grinding halt? Who would have believed that 6 months ago if I had told you that? I don't think anyone would have believed it. I certainly wouldn't have. And remember, before a new economic system can be introduced, the old one must be brought to a halt and slowly dismantled. Enter Operation Corona, the magic wrecking ball that is doing that very thing. You know, hardworking families that would have never dreamed of going on government assistance have been forced to take handouts through no fault of their own. Dependence on government is being rapidly accomplished. Not only financial dependence, but for your physical safety as well. Your very life is in the hands of the feds, or so they want us to believe. People are being trained to look at the government as the savior from the demon known as corona. Your church or spiritual center is just too dangerous to step foot in, but buy that lottery ticket and maybe pick up a bag of weed while you're out. That's no problem. And make a quick stop over at Walmart while you're out. Yeah, only the federal government working hand in hand with Big Pharma can produce the alchemical magic to save us. Only this time the alchemist isn't working on transmuting lead into gold. This time the alchemist is working to produce a magic elixir, that will give you protection from the demon corona and the grim reaper who walks just a few steps behind. Yeah, guys, only the federal government can give you the spiritual, physical, and financial protection that you need. That's what they're trying to sell us anyway, right? Yeah, corona is working. It's alchemical magic to transform you and the very society in which you live. And make no mistake, guys, the coming vaccine will be a contract, not medicine. The vaccine will be a contract. The contract that will allow you entry into the new system. And without it, you cannot enter. And your loyalty will be in question. Yes, the vaccine is also a pledge of loyalty to the new system. Proof that you are a good citizen. And look, guys, they've already made it difficult and nearly impossible in some places to go shopping without a mask. Will it really be such a stretch to be required to show your corona vaccination card in order to go to the store and shop? That's what they're trying to condition us towards. This is just beginning. And will it really be such a leap to have your medical ID chip scanned after another year or two of being temperature scanned to go to the store or into the mall or wherever, you know, people go to gather? Yeah, we really are being conditioned to go through a type of behavioral modification. And fear of the magic virus is your ticket to ride. And the cover for an agenda that would have been unacceptable, absolutely unacceptable, to the general population of America just a short time ago. Suddenly, those of us who are resisting such tyranny are in the minority, considered selfish, and people who don't care about the safety of others. Communitarianism is being accomplished at a staggering pace with such thinking. You know, I saw this sign on a building on television recently, and it said, "My mask protects you, your mask protects me." That's sick. And we can't allow it. And, you know, part of this big solution to this created emergency is we're hearing about this global reset, aren't we? The global reset. Oh, yeah. A lot of talk about that now. And many people are under the mistaken impression that this global reset is only about economics. And yeah, you know, it certainly is about economics. But it's also about the alchemical transmutation of society and the very way in which human beings are allowed to interact with one another. But before they can pull this global reset off, they have to slow down and then shut down the economy almost completely. So I'm expecting many false starts to be coming. You know, for example, you know, sports. Oh, we're getting the sports going. Sports are going. And I guess some sports are starting, but like, you know, football. They started out, some of the players are worried about COVID. They're just not going to play. They're just choosing not to play. And now it's like, oh, it's too dangerous. I don't think we can open college football up. It's just too dangerous. You know, we wanted to, but turns out it's just too dangerous. So, yeah, I think we're going to see more false starts like that. Just kind of like with schools too, right? Some schools are opening. That's true, but you know, a lot of them are going for this virtual learning, which is a joke. And there's already stories of, you know, outbreaks in multiple schools. Oh, 80 kids tested positive here and there. And oh, it's too dangerous. Little kids are just germ factories and they're going to make everyone else sick. Better just keep them home. Don't let them go outside. But, you know, what I'm seeing is that the sad reality is they have no intention of reopening things. They can't because it won't allow the agenda to proceed if they do. You know, even major schools like Harvard have already pledged to have a virtual learning environment. I mean, few of any students are going to walk through those hallowed halls of supposed learning. And instead, they're going to be paying $50,000 a year to sit in front of a computer screen. And again, this is something that would have been unthinkable just a year ago. $50,000 to sit in front of a computer screen. People would have said, no way. But here we are, guys. It's happening. And the slowdown of the economy, I believe, will be followed by a virtual shutdown and a termination of this system as we know it. This is what the global reset is about. And it's coming as long as the herd of humanity, as long as we sleepwalk into our own destruction. And, you know, one thing I find really interesting about this global reset, the whole concept of it, is that we're actually seeing a small group of people who are admitting that they own the system. You know, they're saying, yep, I'm the overlord of this system. And furthermore, they're saying out in the open that we have the power to shut the whole thing down because we say so. And furthermore, they're actually saying openly that they have the power, the raw power, to engineer a new system to their liking that we are to be forced to live under, whether we like it or not. So yes, you know, the shadowy elite are making themselves known more than they ever have. And this is really this idea of the global resource reset. It's the biggest show of power, of raw power ever witnessed, at least in our lifetimes, by far. You know, and it's looking like, you know, you got maybe a couple thousand people at the most. Maybe as low as in the high hundreds of people who essentially have ownership and control over the world's economy. Think about that. That's not very many people. And they actually have the nerve and the confidence to come out and admit it now. Yeah. And, you know, I used to worry about being too paranoid, you know, with my conspiratorial thinking and my conspiratorial mind. And as it turns out, I wasn't paranoid enough. Yeah. How's that for irony, huh? The conspiracy thinker that wasn't paranoid enough. Because this thing is moving faster than I thought it ever would. And I'm sure many other people listening have had similar thoughts. So yeah, our hidden overlords, they're coming out of the shadows and they're saying, hey, we own this system and we can shut it down and we can make a new system to do our bidding and under our schedule. And it's all going to be under the cover of environmentalism and, of course, COVID, the magic virus, the gift that keeps on giving. And, you know, under this new system, the billionaires and the oligarchy, they're not going to lose their money or their control. Quite the opposite. They're consolidating it. And really, in a lot of ways, this corona thing and the global reset is really just a sort of a coming out party for the people that actually run the show. You know, a revelation of the method onto the world stage for all to see. So we're either facing the greatest leap forward for human consciousness and freedom in modern history. We're either facing that or the greatest descent into a new dark ages, you know, where superstition and fear rule. And I don't think there's a lot of room for anything in between, you know? And it's time to start imagining and creating the new system that we choose to live under. And it really does begin on an individual basis. Because, you know, we're in an all-in game here, you know. As Giuseppe said in the past, the chips are all on the table. And we're playing for all the marbles. And one other interesting thing about what's going on is that many things have been unintentionally revealed about the control that we live under. And there's been a lot of revelation about the methodology by which we are controlled as well. I think more so than any time in modern history, we're beginning to see the man behind the curtain pulling the levers. Yeah, the little dog is starting to tear away the curtain. And the other thing is that, you know, globalism has been revealed to be extremely dangerous to humanity, right? If you believe all this pandemic thing, global pandemic, globalism's dangerous, guys. And it's largely unnecessary. And many people are beginning to question the need or even the desire to live in big cities. Right? And we're supposed to just to sit back and let the very people who've screwed up the world beyond belief to keep ruling over us and give them even more power. I don't think so. It can't be allowed to happen. The genie is out of the bottle. And I don't think it's going to be so easy to put the toothpaste back in the tube. Too many things have been revealed unintentionally. And, you know, this oligarchy has really begun to reveal themselves and their maleficence. Their hatred towards the average person is on the global stage for all to see. And, you know, centralization of power, it really is the enemy. And it's time to start thinking about decentralization, about everything, every aspect of our lives. That's going to be the savior, is decentralization. Local owned production of everything is key, right? Everything from the food we eat to the clothes we wear should be produced as close as possible to the consumer. And obviously, some things will need to be shipped and imported, whatever, you know, but that's, we should keep that to a minimum. And the goods need to be owned and produced by people who live in your area. Your neighbors, not a neo-slave class that lives on the other side of the globe. So it's time to start visualizing this, guy. We can't just go along with the ride and let these people shape our reality any longer. And don't forget, visualization is the first step towards creation and manifestation. Visualization. Let's not forget that. We are all, you know, like little small particles of creation, man. And our thoughts really do help build creation. They really do. And frankly, you know, all this excitement about the election and Biden and Trump, the federal government isn't going to fix these problems. You know, I agree. It's better if Trump gets in, no doubt. But the federal government is not going to fix these problems. We have to do it. We got to find new ways of, you know, discovering liberty and freedom. And just to kind of close my opening statement here, you know, this, I was just kind of looking into this global reset, and this is a subject for a whole nother show, but I just want to scratch the surface here very briefly. A lot of this talk about the global reset is coming from this thing called the World Economic Forum. So I just briefly looked into it. And, you know, the head guy is this Klaus Schwab, okay? And, again, he's one of these New World Order elites, and his life story doesn't add up. Apparently, he's just supposedly just a college professor from Switzerland. And, you know, in economics and engineering. And it turns out that this guy that created this World Economic Forum back in 1971, we're just starting to hear about it now. Well, it turns out this Klaus Schwab guy, he's a longtime Bilderberg member, guys. And not only a member of the Bilderberg Committee, he's apparently been on the steering committee, which is, you know, the sort of the top guys get together and form a steering committee in an organization like that. And this guy is just a college professor. There's something about this guy's life we're not being told. And like many things, right? So that said, I'd like to bring in my co-host, Giuseppe, from the District of Criminals. Giuseppe, how you doing, man?
Oh, I'm doing well, Scorpio. Great intro. Really summed it all up, and the summation is not currently going well, but I think the decentralization aspect is vital. Absolutely. I mean, we could start another great step would be to eliminate the indemnification of the big pharma vaccine producers and allow them to be sued out of business. And that would put all the big pharmaceutical companies into bankruptcy. And what would emerge like a phoenix from the ashes would be smaller companies accountable to safe, to delivering safe products, which would be a great start. And then apply the same, sue them out of business to now Bayer with glyphosate. And all of a sudden, you've taken out two of the satanically evil cabals, globalist cabals, that are really destroying this planet and its citizens, not just human citizens, but all life on Earth.
Yeah, and you know, when we were talking before, you had talked about how vaccines have never gone through a double blind test. Could you explain that, just, you know, more in detail to the people listening? I found that to be really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. A double blind placebo test means that you have one group of test participants getting the actual vaccine, and the second group gets a true placebo, which is just a benign substance like a saline solution. So they literally get nothing but salt water in their veins, which is a safe thing to in small doses you can inject into the human body. So at that point, you have a true control, and you can see what is really going on with the proposed vaccine. What the corrupt, evil liars do in the biologics division, which is what vaccines are called in business, the biologics division, they take like a vaccine that was produced a year earlier and test that as the study with the current vaccine. So what you're getting is two vaccines and how well the new vaccine works against the old vaccine, which is essentially a worthless study. And on top of that, even more criminal is the CDC will then take the study and they'll like, oh no. Like, for example, they found the MMR vaccine. For decades, they've known that it really causes autism in black young boys. Of all the various demographic categories, it really tears up the young black boys. And
okay, so vaccines are racist on top of many other things, apparently.
Apparently, huh. Well, that's the whole joke, is we're not all equal. We're one human race, but each of the subgroups, the tribes, has different physiological issues. I mean, that's why black men get sickle cell anemia, but white men do not. And so that's not racist. That's just physiology. And so what's interesting is not only do they have all this knowledge of just how devastating actual vaccines are, they lie and they cherry pick data out of a study and then rewrite the narrative, much like a dirtbag who had immense power about 80, 90 years ago, Edward Bernays, the nephew of Shlomo Freud. That's what's going on today, that the marketing departments and the PR departments in these vaccine corporations get to write the narrative. It's not like Dr. Judy Mikovits had mentioned in her interview with us about 6 weeks ago. It's not data-driven. It's models, and it's outright lie-driven, which is just so criminal. It's unbelievable.
Yeah, that's very interesting. You know, I'm doing a little research for a future show subject, and this corona thing that's happening now in some ways is a repeat of what they tried to accomplish with this swine flu thing back in the 1970s. It's really quite incredible. And I've come across a bunch of newspaper clippings from that time talking about the swine flu, and this could happen, and this many millions of people could die from it. It's really amazing that they're reading or they're from the same playbook that they did back in the 1970s with swine flu.
Well, then they tried to do the swine flu thing again in 2009, the great swine flu scare. And it's interesting. It's definitely a warning of what's coming with the vaccines for the coronavirus. And here's why it's a warning and a cautionary tale. It happened that in China, which gets really hit with these swine flu outbreaks, they produced a vaccine and they tested it on ferrets. Every ferret died. So they're like, well, you know, we'll tweak it and we'll do a human test. And so they did a human test. And they had, I don't know, between 100 and 500 participants. I don't have the exact numbers, but it was a non-trivial amount of humans. And it looked like things were going great. Wow, it works. We've got a vaccine. And so then they waited. They did not introduce it to the general public. They're like, well, let's see what happens the next flu cold season. What happened is the coronavirus had mutated, and so it caused every vaccine test participant to die because their immune system turned on a massive cytokine storm of inflammation, and because it didn't know what to do. It had altered the physiology of these test participants enough that essentially their immune system killed them, and they were like, oh, we can't do this vaccine. And I guarantee you that that is what is going to happen with this Operation Warp Speed. I absolutely guarantee it.
Yeah, it's like, hey, let's just skip all the testing and just start jabbing people with the needle. Let's see what happens, you know. And, you know, about this, I just want to give a little preview of some of the things I've learned. This swine flu thing that happened in 1976, there was a Dr. J. Anthony Morris who was a government flu researcher, and he went off script and said that the swine flu is not contagious and is not a killer, and he warned that the vaccine could induce greater disease than anything that the swine flu could ever do. And he warned that the inoculation program was a potential virological nightmare. This is in 1976. Of course, guess what happened? He got fired, and the government dismantled his entire laboratory, killed all of his animals and his research, and put all of his papers through the paper shredder.
Well, that is exactly what has been going on since the 40s. And in the Dr. Judy Mikovits and Kent Heckenlively's book, Plague of Corruption, the second in a series of books. In fact, I have some breaking news. I was texting with her this morning trying to schedule her next interview with us, and I'll get to that in a moment. Ken Heckenlively is an attorney who wasn't challenged enough and wasn't suffering enough in the corrupt law arena, so he decided to really torture himself and become a sixth-grade science teacher. I mean, geez, talk about a more intense level of Dante's Circles of Hell. Just kidding. And so the
no, he's working his way upward, I think.
Yeah, I guess he's working his way upward. And so essentially there's this thing that's called gain of function, right? Sounds like a benign term, kind of like World Fair, New York, 1962. Gain of function is going to lead us into a new age, right? Well, actually, gain of function is just a euphemism for developing bioweapons, right? So what they do is unnaturally grind up in a blender, literally, a mouse brain with human viruses, and then they let it sit and they test it and see if you've been able to artificially mutate the mouse virus or the human virus to pick up the functions of the other animal, right? In nature, you would have to do, if it ever jumped, and most of these things never jump species, it would be like 500 years, 100 years. It would never happen. And then maybe some weird
cosmic ray would bathe the earth and some aberration would cause it to happen. It doesn't happen very often. But they do this thousands of times until they finally get their jump, right? They finally get, and that's how what we have now with the novel coronavirus, the so-called SARS-CoV-2, is they've managed to put in this cold virus, the corona's common cold, they managed to put in a SARS DNA RNA snippet. They've managed to put in a snippet of a parasite that causes malaria. They managed to put in an HIV RNA snippet and a MERS. MERS is that terrible bug they created that, creates like skin lesions that you absolutely can't. It essentially eats the flesh. It's a flesh-eating bug. And so this is a horrific weapon. And so why do they do this? Well, they've got a $500 billion bioweapons industry that they're not supposed to be doing, and yet every country has this enormous covert operation. And the funny thing is guess who's overseeing most of it? Teeny tiny Tony Fauci. That guy, remember the there were like just horrific comic books in the 50s all about horror, and it was shocking the public back then. And one was called Tales from the Crypt. It was put out by the same people who put out Mad Magazine, Bill Gaines, and I forget what his partner's name was.
Oh yeah,
and it
yeah,
actually
sure.
got it actually got censored, right? So to me, Tony Fauci is the little vampiric monkey attacking people, and the organ grinder is the pharmaceutical military industrial gain of function industry. And so that's how that lowlife incompetent has lasted 50 years. He's intentionally placed there to move all these devious, satanically evil gain of function efforts forward. And that supports your premise of your introduction, which is these globalists, which only in total number, what is there? Maybe, somewhere between 5,000 and 40,000 people involved in this with any kind of real power compared to over 7 billion humans. I mean, they should be wiped off the face of the earth without blinking an eye. I mean, there's so many skilled people with those abilities to hunt humans, but how do they maintain their power? They maintain it through fear, through intimidation, through most people our wage slaves live in check to check, so we'll take away your job. And so it's just insane how this all goes on.
Yeah, yeah. And through deception, of course. That's their favorite method,
right?
Through deception. I just wanted to give a quick shout out to the people in the chat room. We've got Plant Manager 2, Dumpster Diver. Oh, hey, buddy. Credibility Issue, Reg. Amanda Novalis, Vet JD, Greenheart 1, Mayor Bailey, Zippy 101, Fact or Theory, Monster 383, Boy Solomon, Comet, Batsman, Jerbearer 2. Jerbearer does an all-nighter, man, on Revolution Radio. Incredible. I caught some of it early this morning. It was really good stuff, man. Omega Logos, Jimmy Jean, Wall E, Blasphemous Buddha, Simply Red 777, Dirt Engineer, Pat Rabbit, Hummingbird, Maced 139, Mr. Rowe, Surrey Sunflower, Gino 2017, and Popsicle Toes. So we'll be keeping an eye on the chat, looking for good comments. And Giuseppe, I was thinking when you were talking about all these vaccines, it's really amazing. You know, if you buy a soda at the grocery store, there's a list of ingredients on it. You'd think in a sane world, if they're going to inject something into your body with a needle, there might be a list of ingredients on the vaccine. Instead, it's this big mystery witch's brew that we're supposed to just like roll up our sleeves and just, okay, give it to me. It doesn't matter what's in it, whatever you say, and it's just incredible.
Well, right. And even the commercially available vaccines now, when they list the ingredients that are in them, which is what all vaccines are supposed to do, the average person doesn't have the acumen or wherewithal to look up the individual ingredients and what they actually are, let alone how they interact and affect the body, let alone how the ingredients in one vaccine can often augment and amplify the effects of another vaccine. And as you well know, in some of these infants, they're giving newborns, they're giving them 3, 4, 5 vaccines at once, which is just like playing Russian roulette with 4 bullets in the chamber. And it's just criminal. It's satanically evil. And
And it's such a mystery. It's a mystery why there's all these autistic children now, isn't it? It's nothing to right. do with getting 5 vaccines at once when you're a baby. No, that has nothing to do with it.
Right. Nothing to do with the fact that a human doesn't have a functioning immune system until they're about 3 years old. And so in reality, everything they're injecting into these children is just damaging it, the child, the infant's physiology for life. That's why all of a sudden we now have this wave of sick children, these children who are much sicker than the previous generations. So it's just unbelievable that these globalist satanic parasites and their criminal cabals get to just feast on the cattle, the goyim. It's just, but you know, the goyim go along. So it's what are you gonna do? I mean, that's their choice, free will.
Yeah, sleepwalking into our own destruction, right. And people need to wake up and stop it. So Giuseppe, what do you think about this whole World Economic Forum started by a college professor and just this guy who, and supposedly, you know, he's got all the top people going to it, and he was just a regular college professor. He wasn't connected to the Rothschilds or the Rockefellers, and somehow this same guy, this Klaus Schwab, was a member of the Bilderberg Group, a longtime member and a steering committee member of the Bilderberg Group. What are your thoughts on this guy? I mean, he's bizarre. Have you ever seen him speaking? He has this weird blue light behind him, and he's like, oh, we must have the new world order. It's like Dr. Strangelove kind of man.
I think that the globalists, the elites, found a guy that believed in the one world government plan, hook, line, and sinker, and they vetted him to see if he was the perfect front man, and clearly he is, because he has that weird kind of European accent that leads, you know, other citizens of other countries to think, oh, he must be a real smart guy. You know, English is his second language and he's a professor, and he kind of looks kind of cropped like a Nazi. And it's just that's their guy. That's their poster child. They always find these poster children like the clown Bill Gates. I mean, Bill Gates was born 6 inches from home plate, and Bill Gates, in his psychopathic twisted mind, thinks he hit a home run. Bill Gates was given infinite amounts of money to start Microsoft. Bill Gates was too lazy to write his own operating system, so he ripped off some Northwest hippies and bought it and didn't even set up a royalty system from them. Bill Gates hired, you know, hundreds of the world's best computer engineers and software engineers, and all he could produce was this buggy operating system that, you know, broke as often as it worked. And at the same time, he's backed by the overlords of Wall Street and given infinite capital and set up in a virtual monopoly. Bill Gates thinks he did all that, and Bill Gates is out of his mind. And so now Bill Gates for 10 years has decided to become the vaccine messiah for this troubled world, and unbelievable.
Well, yeah, and you know, I don't even buy the official story of Bill Gates. You know, there's a theory going around that I think is very plausible, that this notion that Bill Gates walked into IBM and outsmarted the executives of IBM and made them sign this ridiculous deal, giving them the ability to sell the product to them and to anyone else he wanted to. I think it's a false story. And the theory is that he was a front man for IBM all along, because IBM knew that they wouldn't be able to have control over every aspect of the computer market. So they created this company called Microsoft to throw people off the scent.
I don't dispute your observation at all, although I would say that back in the day, the button down, wear a suit, wear a tie, short haircut, lords of IBM and mainframes, they were pretty arrogant. They were pretty sure mainframes were going to rule forever. So I think there's some kind of machination to set Bill Gates up, and like his father, whose tongue is dyed permanently brown from ass kissing the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds, is the kind of guy who could put that deal together, which is like, look, you're so huge, IBM, and my kid and his cohorts are the next generation. So let's have them take the ball, because you don't really want to, you know, you're mainframe people. You don't want to get involved with consumers and all that. You know, you're business people. And so I could see some type of the intent was always to create the new generation, like I tend to agree. But I think the actual machinations of how it was rolled out, and to a certain extent, I think IBM, the leadership of the time, was deceived.
Well, yeah, that's a very equally plausible theory for sure. But I think ultimately, and on some level, these guys are all playing for the same team, and they have to create different companies so people don't get the idea that, well, hey, wait a minute, you know, there's only a few people running the whole world. You know, they got to have all these different people, you know, so to make people think that the ownership of the world is much larger than it really is, I guess, is what I'm theorizing here.
I agree. Oh, hey, I want to get back to my breaking news. I just got another text from Dr. Judy here. We're seeking to line up an interview with her and Kent Heckenlively together in September. But part two, remember how that 20-minute Plandemic part one was released a couple months ago and had that massive censorship, and yet, you know, hundreds of millions of people like crowd shared it and everybody got to see it anyway. Well, part two is coming officially August 18th, and it's released on the Brian Rose's Freedom platform, the London Real platform, and it's freedomplatform.tv, and it's going to be 5 p.m. UK time, noon Eastern time, Saturday, the 18th, this Tuesday. Okay, so that's coming. And the other news is she's just announced her fourth book, which is called Ending Plague, and it's her and Heckenlively, and also her mentor, Frank Rossetti's joined in now. So that's going to be available at Amazon, and she's asking people to pre-order it, because that prevented censorship the last time. So we'll certainly, and that's coming out in April of 2021. So we'll get to hear a lot more about that in September when she joins us on the show again. So
excellent, excellent. Yeah, it's good to see people that are trying to tell the truth, have some success and make an impact on the world. And that's very encouraging to me.
Agreed. And what is also encouraging is this fella, Dr. Solomon, a heavy hitter from Stanford, who's totally against Fauci and Gates and this insane lockdown. And he's now on Trump's a hard guy to figure out. On the one hand, he announces, oh, we're going to invest $1.3 billion in Moderna. And then the next day, he's got this guy, Dr. Solomon, on his White House advisory panel and introduced him and had him speak. I saw the video earlier this morning, and Solomon is vehemently against this vaccine and this lockdown. So poor Trump, man. That dude is just trying to he's like a one-legged man in an ass-kicking contest. He's trying to keep so many things going at once, and he's limited. But hopefully
– Yeah, you know, I've made the observation before that, you know, whether you love Trump or you hate him, one thing that we've seen clearly from Trump is that the power of the presidency isn't that great when compared to these entrenched bureaucrats and the deep state and the agenda that they represent.
Right, right. Yeah, I think that Trump, in his vast ego, there is some of his Germanic roots, and he understands the parasites he's had to deal with his whole life, and he can't really go against them because they could destroy him. But I think in his heart of hearts, he does have some love for America and real people. I mean, he's got it so cordoned off, walled off. So it's okay for him to be Donald, business is business, Trump, and I'm going to screw the contractors who built Trump Tower, and I'm going to screw everybody else because that's me. I'm a alpha male businessman. But at the same time, he's like, I love the real people and I love this country. You know, it's such a weird paradox, but I think that's what's going on with that guy.
Yeah, and he doesn't have that creepy look in his eyes that so many of these people do, like, you know, Chucky Schumer and, you know, Pelosi, a lot of these other people. They're just creepy looking and repulsive, just the very sight of them. And I don't see that, and I don't feel that kind of energy emanating from him either. So he's certainly a wild card and quite a character, and we'll just have to see where this whole thing goes. You know, I wanted to sort of breach the subject of, you know, what we're going to be covering before the top of the hour hits, because I think this is a really fascinating subject. And it deals with this documentary called Century of the Self that deals with the use of psychology to control humanity and mold society. And what's interesting about this documentary is not only things that it says, but the things that it doesn't say, but things that it sort of opens the door to, but doesn't quite walk through. So it's a fascinating topic, and it's a vast subject. What are your opening thoughts on that?
I would add, or it states things that are obvious disinformation, and I'll just leave that as a teaser. So once we start playing the clips, there's one section in I don't know if it's episode one or episode two, that when we get to it, I'll point that out, but that can be like a teaser for next hour. But I'll tell you what, I've been doing some research for Adam Curtis is the documentary maker, and he's made a whole bunch of them, British writer, journalist, filmmaker. And I, you know, the hours of this show, he's alive. He's like born in 55. So he's like 65, 66 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I've been trying to track him down to see if we could get him to interview. But he did a blog on the BBC, but he ended that in 2016. He was blogging from 2011 to 2016. I'll get you these links. I was researching it. Hoping to surprise you that I could say, hey, I've lined this guy up. But my wife has a lot of business sources in the UK, and I'm going to ask her to see if they can find the guy's email or something. But he's alive, he's well, and he actually runs that YouTube page called Just Adam Curtis, but there's no contact information there. There's nothing on the internet, and he's kind of faded from view since 2016. He's probably, you know, living the sartorial British lordly life now that he's retired, I'm guessing. But anyway, I'm sure at some point we'll be able to find him, but I'd be really interested to have him as an interviewee.
Yeah, that would be fascinating. And, you know, it's amazing. First of all, I think this is one of the best and most intriguing documentaries I've seen. I watched it maybe the first time 10 years ago, and having seen it again, there's just so many different insights I'm seeing that I didn't see before. And it's amazing that Century of the Self was made for BBC when you consider the kind of garbage that BBC pumps out now, it's purely a cultural Marxist organization all the way now. And I guess this was made back in 2002, so it's a fair, you know, it's been out nearly 20 years.
Well, it's interesting that for all its loyalty to the globalist state, BBC lets its content producers have a pretty wide hand in doing its documentaries and things. And up until the last couple of years, I mean, there's been many, many excellent BBC documentaries that never would have gotten made in America, but they were made there. So, yeah, it's too bad that they're finally becoming more of an iron fist towards the cultural Marxist New World Order global government scam.
Yeah, and so this documentary kind of begins talking about Sigmund Freud and his nephew, Edward Bernays. And the incredible influence that these two men had on our society, on our culture, and on our government. And we kind of see how, you know, both, especially Eddie Bernays, went from private working for corporations to working for the CIA to actually constructing coups to overthrow governments, and how this sort of thinking and these theories sort of metastasize further and further out into society over time. And the impact of this is staggering. Most people are just unaware of how much we've been shaped by the Freud family, because Anna Freud, his youngest daughter, gets on the act too later in the episode. Okay, there's the music. We'll be... Okay, welcome back to the Scorpio Conspiracy Show, soon to be renamed Operation Scorpio. I'm here with Giuseppe on Revolution Radio, and we're going to delve into the topic of Century of the Self, which is the implications of this documentary are so massive, and the control that has been put over society using psychology is absolutely tremendous, and it continues at an ever-accelerating pace. Giuseppe, do you have any other opening comments before you want to start playing clips?
Oh, I think that people intuitively know just how much their minds are attacked and controlled and steered, but this fella, Adam Curtis, does an excellent job of laying out the historical precedents and... So I think it's a real eye opener.
It is. And of course, one thing that is left out, I'll just start with this, that's left out, and it had to be left out to get it on to BBC, obviously, is that, you know, everybody in this documentary essentially is Jewish. There's a few people that aren't, but let's say 90 to 95% of every person talked about in this documentary are from a Jewish background. And so, you know, that isn't inherently wrong, but it's important to note because we have, again, a very small population of people that are making tremendous influence upon society and individual people.
No doubt, when the chickens swing, it's a Satanist thing.
Oh, that's pretty good. Okay. All right, man.
So should we play clip one?
Let's go for it, man.
And let me know you can hear it. Here we go.
100 years ago, a new theory about human nature was put forward by Sigmund Freud. He had discovered, he said, primitive sexual and aggressive forces hidden deep inside the minds of all human beings. Forces which, if not controlled, led individuals and societies to chaos and destruction. This series is about how those in power have used Freud's theories to try and control the dangerous crowd in an age of mass democracy. At the heart of the story is not just Sigmund Freud, but other members of the Freud family. When Whipper will call. This episode is about Freud's American nephew, Edward Bernays. Bernays is almost completely unknown today. but his influence on the 20th century was nearly as great as his uncle's. Because Bernays was the first person to take Freud's ideas about human beings and use them to manipulate the masses. He showed American corporations for the first time how they could make people want things they didn't need by linking mass-produced goods to their unconscious desires. Out of this would come a new political idea of how to control the masses. By satisfying people's inner selfish desires, one made them happy and thus docile. It was the start of the all-consuming self, which has come to dominate our world today.
Okay, Giuseppe, what are your thoughts on this opening clip? Where do you want to start?
Sorry, I had to unmute. I think the intro does an excellent overview of what he delves into, which is these things, these movements, these so-called fads are not organic. They're all synthetically created. And I mean, you and I have known that for quite a while, but the average citizen doesn't, and they just fall for it every time. So hopefully most listeners of this show get it as well, but who knows, you know, word of mouth spreading, and somehow got to break that causal link that every time they try to create some new trend or fad, don't go for it. Don't fall for any of this stuff. That's what people need to do.
Well, yeah. And okay. What I find interesting is that, okay, we have the concept of, first of all, using consumer goods to pacify the population. So you satisfy a certain degree of people's wants and desires to keep the population satisfied and pacified. And then the idea that all of the products we buy were part of a grander scheme to mold people's individual personalities through, oh, I like this brand. I relate with this kind of product because that's my kind of like me. So I just find it fascinating, the idea that we're shaping people's identity through the products we buy.
Yes, it's insidious, and sadly, it's incredibly effective.
Insidious, good word. Okay, why don't we go on to the next clip then?
100 years ago, Freud's ideas were hated by Viennese society. At that time, Vienna was the center of a vast empire ruling Central Europe. And to the powerful nobility of the Habsburg court, Freud's ideas were not only embarrassing, but the very idea of examining and analyzing one's inner feelings was a threat to their absolute control.
You see, at that time, these people had the power. And of course, you just were not allowed to show your bloody feelings. I mean, you just couldn't. You know, I mean, you couldn't, if you were unhappy, can you imagine, you, for instance, you sit somewhere in the country in a castle, you are deeply unhappy, you are a woman. You couldn't go to your maid and cry on her shoulders, or you couldn't go into the village and complain, you know, about your feelings. I mean, you couldn't, it was like selling yourself to somebody. You just couldn't, you know, because they had to respect you. Now, of course, Freud, you see, put that thought very much into question, because you see, to examine yourself, you would have to put a lot of other things into question, your society, everything but surrounds you. And that wasn't a good thing at that time.
Why not?
Because your self-created empire, to a certain extent, would have fallen into bits much earlier already.
But what frightened the rulers of the empire even more was Freud's idea that hidden inside all human beings were dangerous instinctual drives. Freud had devised a method he called psychoanalysis. By analyzing dreams and free association, he had unearthed, he said, powerful sexual and aggressive forces, which were the remnants of our animal past. Feelings we repressed because they were too dangerous.
Well, this is very interesting to me because it needs to be put into context, sort of the genesis of Freud's thinking. Freud wrote extensively, if you look through his works, about his deep hatred of society in Vienna at the time of his youth and growing up. He had a deep, deep hatred of it. partly because he didn't feel like, you know, Jewish people were included in the society and they didn't have enough influence over society. So, you know, the genesis of this in some ways, and I'm not going to discount all the thinking, because he did hit upon some very true things about human nature, but that's the genesis of his thinking and his loathing of the people of Vienna as a young man. Your thoughts?
Well, of all the countless stars in the sky, it's only equaled by the countless Jewish intellectual frauds, of which my mind, Shlomo Freud, is one of the largest. He's just a joke. I mean, the fact that he could pick up some insights into human nature that anybody could get, and his idea is so vacuous, so shallow, like the classic, I know an elephant is because I'm touching the tail. That's Sigmund Freud. He doesn't even take into account the idea of in Taoism and Oriental medicine, the triangle of body, mind, and spirit. He doesn't even take into account the energetics of the chakra system in Ayurvedic thinking. He doesn't understand the linkages of all that. And so what you have, as you observed, is you've got this this weaselly, insecure, bright Jew who has no spiritual practice and who's beset by and fed upon by these type of demonic little parasites, vampires, and that affects his worldview. So he only is touching the elephant's tail, and yet the Jewish media and the Jewish intellectual community prop this guy up like he's some kind of visionary, and I think he's a clown.
Well, you know, those are some great points, Giuseppe, and of course, you know, the genesis of this was hatred. He had a hatred of this society, and so he set about to try to mold it in his own worldview. And I thought you made a great point about the complete lack of spiritual understanding. It's all materialism is what it comes down to.
Right. And factor in that Freud's projections were all from his own deviant illness, internal illness, that he was a pedophile. He had these hatred issues. He was a cocaine addict. And this guy understands the nature of human reality. What a joke.
Yeah. And despite all the flaws that you mentioned and the glaring inconsistencies and problems with the thinking, it entered the world stage unlike anything that's ever happened up to that point in terms of, you know, understanding the human psyche. It took the world by storm, and this documentary is going to kind of go into that and the influence it had.
Exactly right. Should I play the next one?
Yes, good idea.
At that time, Freud's young nephew, Edward Bernays, was working as a press agent in America. His main client was the world-famous opera singer Caruso, who was touring the United States.
La donna immobile, qual più malvolto.
Bernays's parents had emigrated to America 20 years before, but he kept in touch with his uncle and joined him for holidays in the Alps. But Bernays was now about to return to Europe for a very different reason. On the night that Caruso opened in Toledo, Ohio, America announced it was entering the war against Germany and Austria. As a part of the war effort, the US government set up a committee on public information, and Bernays was employed to promote America's war aims in the press. The president, Woodrow Wilson, had announced that the United States would fight not to restore the old empires, but to bring democracy to all of Europe. Bernays proved extremely skillful in promoting this idea, both at home and abroad. And at the end of the war, he was asked to accompany the president to the Paris Peace Conference.
Okay, Giuseppe, why don't you take this first?
Well, Eddie Bernays, because Shlomo Freud, his cocaine addiction, he had pretty much burned through his wealth and the insane amount of hyperinflation going on in Vienna pre-war. He asked his nephew for help, and his nephew actually got access to Shlomo's ramblings, right? And his nephew was like, oh my God, I can't believe how much this can be used. And it's sad because what you have is the deviant, clever, I don't even want, he's not a genius. He's like, I don't know what he is. Well, he's a parasite. But it's so funny that it resonated with so many people of the day who, let's face it, talk therapy is a good thing. You know, you do want to unburden yourself. I mean, that's the idea for centuries with Catholic confession, and every society has some type of a function where, you know, it used to be you could talk to your grandfather or talk to your uncle or talk to someone and unburden yourself and then get some feedback and pick up some wisdom if you're open to it. And so, you know, talk therapy is great. You know, a support group, a support system is important. It's always been, but for him to turn it into the massive revolution that he did is just really something. And it really transformed society to being incredibly shallow and manipulated. I mean, in the earlier clip, it said,
yeah,
you know, the elites of Vienna wanted nothing to do with expressing their feelings and all that. And now it's gone to the point where, number one, everybody needs a special safe space and a blankie and needs to have a good cry if the presidential candidate you wanted didn't get elected. And then going back to the Bernays things, holy cow, did he realize what a powerful weapon he had, and did he use it effectively?
Yeah, those are great points. You know, the only thing I would add to this is they mentioned that basically Eddie Bernays got involved in war propaganda to convince Americans to get into World War One. World War One was not a popular affair by any stretch of the imaginations. Most Americans wanted nothing to do with it whatsoever. They saw it as a European war, and it wasn't their business. So Americans were propagandized on a massive scale to get them to go along with this war. And secondly, Woodrow Wilson was an absolute tyrant. He actually locked up people that did not want to, or that were speaking out against the war. And so it was really, you know, to put this into context, this was extremely unpopular, and Bernays was involved in tricking the American public to going along with it.
Right. Two points about Bernays. Before the World War II effort, he had been hired by a tobacco company because society at the time was very patriarchal, and it was considered unladylike for women to smoke. So Bernays was like using his Uncle Shlomo's mind tricks, realized that ladies, and he hired some women during a parade in New York to pull out some cigarettes and light up. And then
I think that's coming on the very next
clip. Oh, it's coming up. Okay, my bad.
Yeah, why don't we go ahead and play that? Because that's huge.
Okay.
Wilson's reception in Paris astounded Bernays and the other American propagandists. Their propaganda had portrayed Wilson as a liberator of the people, a man who would create a new world in which the individual would be free. They had made him a hero of the masses. And as he watched the crowd surge around Wilson, Bernays began to wonder whether it would be possible to do the same type of mass persuasion, but in peacetime.
When I came back to the United States, I decided that if you could use propaganda for war, you could certainly use it for peace. And propaganda got to be a bad word because of the Germans using it. So what I did was to try to find some other words. So we found the word Council on Public Relations.
Bernays returned to New York and set up as a public relations council in a small office off Broadway. It was the first time the term had ever been used. Since the end of the 19th century, America had become a mass industrial society, with millions clustered together in the cities. Bernays was determined to find a way to manage and alter the way these new crowds thought and felt. To do this, he turned to the writings of his uncle Sigmund. While in Paris, Bernays had sent his uncle a gift of some Havana cigars. In return, Freud had sent him a copy of his General Introduction to Psychoanalysis. Bernays read it, and the picture of hidden irrational forces inside human beings fascinated him. He wondered whether he might make money by manipulating the unconscious.
Okay, making money by manipulating the unconscious. Well, what do you think about that, Giuseppe?
I think that Edward Bernays is a fine example of the level of character of his tribe.
Well, yeah, just anything that comes up, hey, can we make money on this or not? You know, it's just, and you know, everybody wants to make money, but everything can't be reduced to like, hey, can we make money on this or not? You know, yeah. Very interesting. Yeah, I think the thing on the women smoking is the very next clip. So maybe we should just jump towards that now.
You got it.
Bernays set out to experiment with the minds of the popular classes. His most dramatic experiment was to persuade women to smoke. At that time, there was a taboo against women smoking. And one of his early clients, George Hill, the president of the American Tobacco Corporation, asked Bernays to find a way of breaking it.
He said, we're losing half of our market because men have invoked the taboo against women smoking in public. Can you do anything about that? I said, let me think about it. And then I said, have I your permission to see a psychoanalyst to find out what cigarettes mean to women? He said, what'll it cost? So I called up Dr. Brill, A.A. Brill, who was the leading psychoanalyst in New York at that time.
How come you didn't call your uncle? Why didn't you call your uncle?
Because he was in Indiana.
A.A. Brill was one of the first psychoanalysts in America. And for a large fee, he told Bernays that cigarettes were a symbol of the penis and of male sexual power. He told Bernays that if he could find a way to connect cigarettes with the idea of challenging male power, then women would smoke, because then they would have their own penises. Every year, New York held an Easter Day parade to which thousands came, and Bernays decided to stage an event there. He persuaded a group of rich debutantes to hide cigarettes under their clothes. Then they should join the parade, and at a given signal from him, they were to light up the cigarettes dramatically. Bernays then informed the press that he had heard that a group of suffragettes were preparing to protest by lighting up what they called torches of freedom.
He knew this would be an outcry, and he knew that all of the photographers would be there to capture this moment, and so he was ready with a phrase, which was torches of freedom. And so here you have a symbol, women, young women, debutantes, smoking a cigarette in public with a phrase that means anybody who believes in this kind of equality pretty much has to support them in the ensuing debate about this, because torches of freedom. I mean, what's on all American coins? It's liberty. She's holding up the torch. You see, and so all of this is there together. There's emotion, there's memory, there's a rational phrase, even though it's using a lot of emotional elements, it's a phrase that works in a rational sense. All of this is together.
Yeah, that's okay. So look, Bernays consults another Jewish psychologist who just happened to work right next door to Freud back in Vienna, but is in New York City now. So again, we're in a very small circle of people. And what's interesting here is that essentially what he did is he got, you know, he created some fake news, didn't he? He used basically what we would call crisis actors today, people who you thought were just women on the street, but this is all a pre-planned event. And he essentially created, you know, an event that we would call fake news today. So if you extrapolate this, that means that the government and the media were aware of this technique of just creating a fake event using actors. And they've known that since at least the 1920s. So in my mind, I think we need to question almost every major media event that happened after this singular event, because after that point, the door was open to this kind of thinking, and it was out there in the consciousness of the government. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe?
Well, they, of course, knew how it worked, because remember, about 30 years earlier, William Randolph Hearst, the so-called yellow journalist, which is essentially propaganda and lies, did remember the Maine as an excuse to get the U.S. Army to go in and take over for the banana, the fruit company.
Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. And yeah, I've been hearing about this show, The Perfect Triangle, with some guy called Giuseppe. Comes on Friday night, 6 p.m. Eastern, Studio A. I wanted just to read a couple of things from the chat that I found to be very interesting. Mayor Bailey says, if not for Bernays, Freud and psychiatry would not be known. That's true. Absolutely. And, Greenheart One says therapist. That breaks down to the rapist. Huh, that's true. Never thought of that. Clever. And then Jimmy Jean saying Fabian socialist et al. And Marx and Engels were also cokeheads. So yeah, cocaine gives you some bad thinking. It looks like, I don't recommend it. And, you know, one last comment, Giuseppe, about this clip here is that, you know, the cigarette represents the penis, blah, blah, blah. Okay, maybe so. But, you know, it's a deliberate attempt to keep man's thinking at the most base level rather than going into the spiritual realm, as you were alluding to earlier.
Right. And a lot of working men of the time must have been repressed homosexuals if they had to keep putting that tobacco penis in their mouth many times a day.
Yeah, surely so. Well, we'll have to do some more referencing on that. Okay, maybe go on to the next clip if you're ready.
What Bernays had created was the idea that if a woman smoked, it made her more powerful and independent. An idea that still persists today.
Embrace me, my sweet embrace.
It made him realize that it was possible to persuade people to behave irrationally if you link products to their emotional desires and feelings. The idea that smoking actually made women freer was completely irrational, but it made them feel more independent. It meant that irrelevant objects could become powerful emotional symbols of how you wanted to be seen by others.
Eddie Bernays saw the way to sell product was not to sell it to your intellect, that you ought to buy an automobile, but that you will feel better about it if you have this automobile. I think he originated that idea, that they weren't just purchasing something, but they were engaging themselves emotionally or personally in the product or service. That it's not, you think you need a new piece of clothing, but you'll feel better with the piece of clothing. That was his contribution in a very real sense. We see it all over the place today, but I think he originated the idea of the emotional connect to a product or service.
Well, I would just add that, you know, we take that for granted now in our society. We're not even aware of how ubiquitous this concept has become. It's just normal that, oh, you base your personality on the brand names that you like. I mean, it's really, as you said, insidious.
it is insidious. And if you think about it, what Shlomo Freud, the deviant that he was with no spiritual practice, was essentially figured out how to activate and entice people into the seven sins: lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, and pride. An individual with a spiritual practice, you know, somehow when we incarnate into this world, we're wired into other dimensions. And some of those dimensions are just evil. And that's where that all comes from. That's his so-called ego, right? And in reality, if you become a spiritually mature and disciplined person, you are always hearing those voices or urges, but you discipline yourself to connect with divine light, divine energy, the Christ consciousness, whatever you want to call it. And that is such a purer divine love that can help you avoid all the baser temptations. And yet few people in this modern society are taught that, and even less practice it. But everyone's like, oh, I gotta get my bends, man. I gotta get my tattoo, because everybody's got tattoos and I'll be cool. Like, you know, it's just so shallow, so immature, so weak-minded, and yet that's the control. It's stunning.
Those are some profound points, and wow, that's really very interesting. I hadn't considered all that, but I totally agree with it. And, you know, we have to keep in mind that the genesis of this kind of thinking, that human beings are dangerous and have to be controlled because they're just really, you know, irrational animals. This kind of thinking originates in the Talmud. And I don't think you can have an honest conversation about Freud without at least mentioning that. And as you said, the absolute disconnection between that thinking and the higher realm spiritual thinking is profound.
Right. And you have to understand that not all Jews practice Babylonian, Talmudic, satanic blood magic, right? I mean, the Torah is much more enlightened. There's some amazingly decent Jews. I mean, it's just like the media will say the Russians did this or the Chinese. Well, if it's okay to slam an entire people, we can say the Jew, but we're not saying, you know, because it's, you know, all we'd be doing is, well, we're talking about a death cult little subsection that hides behind the decent Jews. That's right. That's what we are doing, but we shouldn't have to say it every time. And I'm really happy to see, like, last year there was 10,000 Jews got together in Madison Square Garden to protest what Netanyahu was doing and the Likud party. And, you know, hopefully at some point they get rid of him and those lunatics, because, you know, the regular decent Jews are amazingly cool people. And yet they're not driving the Israeli bus. They're not driving the globalist bus. That bus, which its immense power is being driven by Talmudic globalist Satanists. And that's what needs to change.
Yeah, just a handful of people, essentially. And yeah, it really is about the individual, not about attaching every single person to this group that determines their behavior. Okay, well, let's go on to the next clip then.
What Bernays was doing fascinated America's corporations. They had come out of the war rich and powerful, but they had a growing worry. The system of mass production had flourished during the war, and now millions of goods were pouring off production lines. What they were frightened of was the danger of overproduction, that there would come a point when people had enough goods and would simply stop buying. Up until that point, the majority of products were still sold to the masses on the basis of need. While the rich had long been used to luxury goods, for the millions of working-class Americans, most products were still advertised as necessities. Goods like shoes, stockings, even cars were promoted in functional terms for their durability. The aim of the advertisements was simply to show people the product's practical virtues, nothing more. What the corporations realized they had to do was transform the way the majority of Americans thought about products. One leading Wall Street banker, Paul Mazur of Lehman Brothers, was clear about what was necessary. "We must shift America," he wrote, "from a needs to a desires culture. People must train to desire, to want new things, even before the old have been entirely consumed."
Prior to that time, there was no American consumer. There was the American worker, and there was the American owner, and they manufactured, and they saved, and they ate what they had to, and the people shopped for what they needed. And while the very rich may have bought things they didn't need, most people did not. And Mazur envisioned a break with that, where you would have things that you didn't actually need, but you wanted, as opposed to needed.
And the man who would be at the center of changing that mentality for the corporations was Edward Bernays.
Bernays really is the guy within the United States, more than anybody else, who sort of brings to the table psychological theory as something that is an essential part of how, from the corporate side, of how we are going to appeal to the masses effectively, and the whole sort of merchandising establishment and sales establishment is ready for Sigmund Freud. I mean, they are ready for understanding what motivates the human mind.
Wow. What are your thoughts on that, Giuseppe?
That is so devious and evil. Man's desires must overshadow his needs. Just imagine if the decent people of that day had said F you to Bernays, F you to John D. Rockefeller and his destruction of the natural medicine profession that was the equal of the allopathic back in the day, and destroyed by the two evil Jews, the Flexner brothers. Just imagine if the commitment would have been made in parallel to hemp and all its wonders, instead of how much better if people continue. But you know what? There was a lot of saving going on even up until like the 70s. And then in the 80s, that whole mind rape of greed is good from that Gordon Gekko movie, Wall Street. And that really was the tipping point to turn everybody into a rabid consumer. Up until then, a lot of people saved, and it's a sad commentary. And man, it was like, you know, there prior to Bernays and his deviant ways, there was no real American consumer. There was the American worker. Worker equals strong and in control. Consumer equals weak and needy, controlled by fads. What a degeneration of the society.
Yeah, that's so so cogent. And, you know, now it's just accepted that, well, you know, your need outweighs – I mean, your desire outweighs your needs. And that's just ubiquitous in our society. And you know, like, for example, my grandparents, their generation – my grandfather was born in 1905. Those people really weren't consumers as much as they were. They bought things they needed. And it's incredible the shift we've undergone. And, you know, that whole greed is good thing, an actual guy said that, a Jewish stock market wizard said that in real life as well. I think he ended up going to jail for a while. I think it was Even Boesky who said that, actually. And I think he ended up going to jail for a short time in the 80s. But, yeah, it's just a ubiquitous thinking now that it's just 100 years ago, people didn't think that way. And that's really not very long ago.
Oh, I know. I mean, I have similar tales to tell of I'm paternally Sicilian, second generation, and maternally German, Austrian, fourth generation. And I remember, and I knew both my sets of grandparents. They're all passed now, long ago, but they were like, you know, they didn't consume. They were like, this has to make sense to spend money on it, because they had all lived through the Depression, which was basically caused by these Zionist parasites.
Yeah, it was definitely a caused event. And you know, we're talking about the 1920s, what's happening in these clips at this point. So why don't we go on to the next clip?
Beginning in the early 20s, the New York banks funded the creation of chains of department stores across America. They were to be the outlets for the mass-produced goods, and Bernays's job was to produce the new type of customer. Bernays began to create many of the techniques of mass consumer persuasion that we now live with. He was employed by William Randolph Hearst to promote his new women's magazines, and Bernays glamorized them by placing articles and advertisements that linked products made by others of his clients to famous film stars like Clara Bow, who was also his client. Bernays also began the practice of product placement in the movies. He was, he claimed, the first person to tell car companies they could sell cars as symbols of male sexuality. He employed psychologists to issue reports that said products were good for you, and then pretended they were independent studies. He organized fashion shows in department stores and paid celebrities to repeat the new and essential message. You bought not just for need, but to express your inner sense of yourself to others.
Well, you know, the thing that really strikes me about this last segment here is that he says that the banks, by this time, the 1920s, the banks had lent out money to create department store chains. So it was the banks that made that lent out money to essentially their friends and family members a lot of times to create these big chains of department stores in the 1920s. And this sort of created the playing field for this kind of mindset and thinking to be played out in real life.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it was a classic scenario where you take care of your own, you prop them up. And there's a lot of smart people. They saw what Eddie Bernays was doing, and they could extrapolate what this could mean. And boy, did they reap the benefits of it. And sadly, to the detriment of our society and our country.
Well, and we're seeing sort of the creation of reality as we've known it in the 20th century. This is the, you know, sort of the beginning of it, its genesis, and the kind of thinking that went behind it. Of course, this is complex, and it's not, you know, a one-dimensional kind of thing, but this is a big part in what happened.
Well, it's sad that so many people back then had such mundane lives. And what is it? The American writer John, I can't think of his last name, but he said that back then people leading lives of quiet desperation. And so even then they fantasized about the actors or the people they heard on the radio, like Caruso or these other people. And they were escaping even then, and it's sad to have it be preyed upon by these parasites.
Yeah, they're exploiting essential parts of human nature for not the highest gains, of course. Okay, well, why don't we go on with the next clip here and see what we get.
In 1927, an American journalist wrote, "A change has come over our democracy. It is called consumptionism. The American citizen's first importance to his country is now no longer that of citizen, but that of consumer." The growing wave of consumerism helped in turn to create a stock market boom. And yet again, Edward Bernays became involved, promoting the novel idea that ordinary people should buy shares, borrowing money from banks he also represented. And yet again, millions followed his advice.
People in large numbers are going to react to products and ideas and so on. But in political terms, if he were to go out, so I can't imagine that he could get three people to stand and listen. was a kind of funny looking and didn't have any sense of reaching out for people one-on-one. None at all. He didn't think about people in groups of one, thought about people in groups of thousands.
Yeah, so the mass herd, let's think of people in the herd. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe?
It's interesting, once again, getting into the energetics of what animates this meatbot shell, is there is a group herd mentality that can be easily, it de-evolves, you know? I mean, rational people can be made to do violent, horrible things when they're in a crowd. There's like a crowd mind that takes over. It's fascinating. And once again, these parasites figure out a way to use it for the negative. Whereas if you were to truly teach people and train them in spiritual discipline to turn that into a positive with powerful million people praying together, real prayer. And most people are so spiritually immature and don't even understand how to focus that energy. Could you imagine if that training were done and there are millions of people, there'd be no world wars, there'd be no starvation, suffering. It would lift the group consciousness that we all share at some point and at some level, yeah. Rather. Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, we should put this into context. We got the Federal Reserve was, you know, created just a little bit before World War I started. Then, you know, the Council on Foreign Relations at the same time, roughly. So we're seeing all the – and then, you know, these big department stores being created through massive lending from banks. So we're just seeing the creation of the playing field that this whole thing comes out on. Why don't we try to squeeze in one more clip before we hit the top of the hour?
But while Bernays became rich and powerful in America, in Vienna, his uncle was facing disaster. Like much of Europe, Vienna was suffering an economic crisis and massive inflation, which wiped out all of Freud's savings. Facing bankruptcy, he wrote to his nephew for help. Bernays responded by arranging for Freud's works to be published for the first time in America, and began to send his uncle precious dollars, which Freud kept secretly in a foreign bank account.
He was Freud's agent, if you will, to get his books published. Well, of course, once the books were being published, Eddie couldn't help himself but to promote these books, see that everybody read them, make them controversial, emphasize the fact that, do you know what Freud says about sex and what he says cigarettes are a symbol of and so on and so forth? How do you suppose all those stories got out? Certainly the academics weren't spreading these around the country. Eddie Bernays was. Then, when Freud became accepted, well, then, of course, to go to apply and say, well, Uncle Siggy, see, then that had some cachet. But notice there, first Eddie created Uncle Siggy in the U.S., made him acceptable, secondly, and thirdly, then capitalized on Uncle Siggy. Typical Bernays performance.
Yeah, let's make some money on it. Why not? And just like Mayor Bailey was saying, without Bernays, Freud would be completely unknown, and let's, you know, create controversy, and because that helps sell whatever product you're selling.
Yeah, absolutely right. I mean, the power of specious lies, half truths, is known for many, many years. You know, I mean, look at Devil Bill Rockefeller used to go town to town telling people this snake oil or this miracle concoction, which was just toxic garbage, will cure your bursitis, cure your arthritis. And then he'd sell a bunch and he'd skedaddle out of town before they realized it was making him sick. I mean, it's sad that the weasel way is much easier to achieve than the noble, honorable way.
Oh, that's a very good point. And, of course, a lot of these elixirs and tonics that Devil Bill was selling, you know, either had cocaine or heroin in them. So, amazingly, yeah, you had extra energy or your bursitis went away, you know. So, yeah, essentially a drug dealer.
Right.
Yeah, Yeah. what else? Do you have any other thoughts on that last bit of clips? Because we got about 1 minute left before we hit the top of the hour.
Yeah, the celebrity envy and influence and product placement now are accepted sacraments in the religion of consumerism. And phony paid experts, the high priests of the phony religion of consumerism.
Oh, that's well said, the phony religion of consumerism. And it's just an accepted fact of life now. We don't even question that. And it's only been in existence for really about 100 years. It's not very long. And it could easily be reversed as this paradigm that we're under now is sort of unraveling, partly on purpose. And new ways of living could be created right now. And I don't know that these controllers are going to be able to hold on to their absolute power over the minds of humanity for much longer. Okay, well, that's the top of the hour music. Everybody stay tuned. We'll be right back. Okay, welcome back to the third and final hour. I am Scorpio here with Giuseppe on Revolution Radio. And we're discussing the documentary Century of the Self because it covers so many deep and fundamental aspects of the world that we're living in and how that world or that playing field was created. Giuseppe, why don't we just jump right back in and go on with the next clip and see where it takes us.
You got it.
Bernays also suggested that Freud promote himself in the United States. He proposed his uncle write an article for Cosmopolitan, a magazine that Bernays represented, entitled A Woman's Mental Place in the Home. Freud was furious. Such an idea, he said, was unthinkable. It was vulgar, and anyway, he hated America. Freud was now becoming increasingly pessimistic about human beings. In the mid-20s, he retreated in the summers to the Alps, sometimes staying in an old hotel, the Pension Moritz in Berchtesgaden. It is now a ruin. Freud began to write about group behavior, about how easily the unconscious aggressive forces in human beings could be triggered when they were in crowds. Freud believed he had underestimated the aggressive instincts in human beings. They were far more dangerous than he had originally thought.
After World War I, Freud was basically a pessimist. He felt that man is an impossible creature, a very, very sadistic and bad species, and did not believe that man can be improved. Man is a ferocious animal, the most ferocious animal that exists. They enjoy torturing and killing, and he didn't like men.
The publication of Freud's works in America had an extraordinary effect on journalists and intellectuals in the 1920s. What fascinated and frightened them was the picture Freud painted of submerged, dangerous forces lurking just under the surface of modern society. Forces that could erupt easily to produce the frenzied mob which had the power to destroy even governments. It was this they believed had happened in Russia. To many, this meant that one of the guiding principles of mass democracy was wrong. The belief that human beings could be trusted to make decisions on a rational basis. The leading political writer, Walter Lippmann, argued that if human beings were in reality driven by unconscious, irrational forces, then it was necessary to rethink democracy. What was needed was a new elite who could manage what he called the bewildered herd. This would be done through psychological techniques that would control the unconscious feelings of the masses.
Well, you know, what I find interesting is, you know, here Freud is becoming darker as time goes on in his perception of man, or you could say non-Jews maybe. And, you know, he starts off hating Austrian society and then freely admits that he hates America, which is fine. That's a great guiding light to help shape our society. And Marcus is saying in the chat room that America is a mistake, Freud said. A gigantic mistake, it is true, but nonetheless a mistake.
Well, a few years ago, there was a book published called, A New Biography Demolishes Whatever Was Left of the Viennese Con Man's Reputation. Let's see what the name of this is. Oh, Freud, The Making of an Illusion. He's just a fraud, a charlatan. His giddy throes of his fondness for cocaine. He was a pedophile. We talked earlier last hour about how his own darkness, his own lack of any kind of spiritual acumen or connection with the divine, and he projects all this stuff out. And what's funny is this is where the author, like you said, leaves things unsaid. Well, the German people were tormented by the globalist bankers, and so the German people were cultivated to have hatred for the Jews because of the Treaty of Versailles and the hyperinflation and the total ridiculous level of oppressive reparations that was negotiated, when in reality, had the Jew Samuel Untmeyer not stepped in and propped up Woodrow Wilson by paying off his adulterous affair, and then saying, Woody, at some point we'll need a favor, and the two favors were the Federal Reserve and entering World War II, and actually three favors because it was World War One. I totally lost my train of thought. I was looking at this article. Anyway, the point being is that the Germans would have had won World War One. They were happy to stop where it was, and the insane amount of oppressive reparations led to a real resentment because people back then were far more intelligent than the average schmo now, and they knew who did what to them, and so it's all, he acts like he operates in a vacuum, and Freud, so anyway, you get it.
Yeah, if you put it in context of other things that are happening with other Jewish power brokers, it all starts to make a lot more sense, and it's not an isolated event, it's part of a grander scale. So you brought up World War II earlier. This sort of thinking that the individual could not be trusted and had to be controlled and guided bled into the government. We probably won't get that today, but it bled into the government because of this new Jewish elite that was forming. And they were afraid that what happened in Germany could possibly happen in America. And so they clamped down their control even tighter to make sure that what they were up to would never be revealed. So anyway, I thought that was an interesting, kind of preview of what's coming. Why don't we go on to the next clip and see where we go?
Absolutely. I remembered the third betrayal of Woodrow Wilson, which was putting the first Jew, the traitor Louis Brandeis, on the Supreme Court. That was the third terrible event.
Yes.
Edward Bernays was fascinated by Lippmann's arguments and also saw a way to promote himself by using them. In the 1920s, he began to write a series of books which argued that he had developed the very techniques Lippmann was calling for. By stimulating people's inner desires and then sating them with consumer products, he was creating a new way to manage the irrational force of the masses. He called it the engineering of consent.
Democracy, to my father, was a wonderful concept. But I don't think he felt that all those publics out there had reliable judgment, and that they very easily might vote for the wrong man or want the wrong thing, so that they had to be guided from above. It's enlightened despotism, in a sense.
Ah, well, we're seeing an elite form. And it's funny, just fast forward to today. Oh, they might vote for the wrong man. Huh, interesting.
Enlightened despotism, the arrogance, the hubris that they know better than what's good for most people. It's funny, even to this day, you talk to most people and they have a pretty good idea of what would be good for themselves, their community, and the country. That's why they always vote for change. But unfortunately, the system is so rigged and so controlled by these globalist parasites now. The money party, the uniparty, splits into two phony, fake differentials. There's no real difference in the corridors of power between the Republicans and the Democrats, none whatsoever. They both serve the globalist elites. And so enlightened despotism, I think you can drop the enlightened these days. It's just despotism.
Right. The mask comes off, so to speak. I totally agree. Very interesting. Okay, well, maybe we'll go on to the next clip and see where we go.
Throughout the 1920s, speculators had borrowed billions of dollars. The banks had promoted the idea that this was a new era where market crashes were a thing of the past. But they were wrong. What was about to happen was the biggest stock market crash in history. Investors had panicked and begun to sell in a blind, relentless fury that no reassurance by bankers or politicians could halt. And on the 29th of October 1929, the market collapsed. The effect of the crash on the American economy was disastrous. Faced with recession and unemployment, millions of American workers stopped buying goods they didn't need. The consumer that Bernays had done so much to engineer disappeared, and professional public relations fell from favor. Bernays' brief moment of power seemed to be over. The effect of the Wall Street crash on Europe was also catastrophic. It intensified the growing economic and political crisis in the new democracies. In both Germany and Austria, there were violent street battles between the armed wings of different political parties. Against this backdrop, Freud, who was suffering from cancer of the jaw, retreated yet again to the Alps. To book. Called Civilization and Its Discontents. It was a powerful attack on the idea that civilization was an expression of human progress. Instead, Freud argued, civilization had actually been constructed to control the dangerous animal forces inside human beings. What was implicit in Freud's argument was that the ideal of individual freedom, which was at the heart of democracy, was impossible. Human beings could never be allowed to truly express themselves because it was too dangerous. They must always be controlled and would thus always be discontent.
Human beings could never be allowed to fully express themselves. It sounds like Freud is sort of upset with the creator and didn't like the creation and felt that maybe he could fix it and make it better.
Well, you have accurately and in your enlightened despotism pointed out again and again that mankind, humanity, is being suppressed from growing into its true potential. And we're listening to exactly how it's being done.
Yeah, good point. Good point. Well, the time is just flying by. So why don't we go on to the next clip and discuss that one.
And in America, too, democracy was under threat from the force of the angry mob. The effect of the stock market crash had been disastrous. There was growing violence as an angry population took out their frustration on the corporations who were seen to have caused this disaster. Then, in 1932, a new president was elected who was also going to use the power of the state to control the free market. But his aim was not to destroy democracy, but to strengthen it. And to do this, he was going to develop a new way of dealing with the masses.
I am prepared, under my constitutional duty, to recommend the measures that a stricken nation in the midst of a stricken world may require. But in the event that the national emergency is still critical, I shall evade a clear course of duty that will then confront me. For the one remaining instrument to meet the crisis, executive power.
It was the start of what would become known as the New Deal. Roosevelt assembled a group of young technocrats and planners in Washington. He told them that their job was to plan and run giant new industrial projects for the good of the nation. Roosevelt was convinced that the stock market crash had shown that laissez-faire capitalism could no longer run modern industrial economies. It had become the job of government.
Okay, enter Franklin Delano Roosevelt. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe, on this?
Young technocrats, i.e. technocracy born, and now we are under the despotic reign of technocracy, the censorship of YouTube, Google, Facebook, Twitter, the oppression of the vaccine industry with the 10-year plan of the vaccine messiah technocrat Bill Gates. It's like, holy cow, it's amazing to see how these seeds were sown. And I also believe that many elements of the New Deal were really brilliant. And some people believe Roosevelt did it because he and his advisors realized if they didn't really throw a bone to the average person, the government was going to fall. It wasn't going to exist. And so the massive job plans are unfortunately what Trump should have done when he got elected. And because, you know, going back to the idea of becoming a consumer, you look at the underclass, the black especially, and what do they do when they get any kind of money? They want to wear gold chains and have gold teeth with little spinners on their teeth, just like the spinners on their cars. And it's all superficial because they feel so insecure and so lacking of any security that they want to show off like they have something. And that's just really tragic. Imagine if the impoverished underclass had living wage jobs, how much more stable society would be, how much more commitment there'd be to the family unit and all things that are really necessary.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. And, you know, it is true that FDR was – his programs were very popular with some people. Some people absolutely hated him as well. Depending on who you ask. And, you know, FDR is the one that really expanded and mushroomed the federal government. And at the same time, we saw the influence, the growing influence of sort of socialist thinking and also a lot of more Jewish influence upon the government. So Roosevelt was an interesting character, and you're right. Some of those programs were very popular, but of course, what was the catalyst to make that happen? Well, the giant stock market crash, which was done on purpose and pre-planned. Right. And we're kind of seeing a similar, you know, technique with this COVID thing. Oh, we're crashing the whole economy this time, and everyone's going to need to get, you know, a government subsistence help because we shut the economy down. And if the Democrats take power, we're going to see a massive expansion of what the government does in people's lives. And just one last thing, Reg in the chat room made an interesting observation that really happy, relaxing music came on when they started talking about FDR.
That's funny. Yeah, the funny thing is, Scorpio, in my mind, the difference between a massive jobs program to put people to work, having self-sufficiency and a living wage check is way different and the right way to go versus the current strategy under the new normal and the Great Reset, which is to just reward self-indulgence and stay home and play video games and make TikTok videos on your phone, and it's just a waste of a life. I mean, to me, those are key differences, and that's where a lot of people who are ignorant to the fact of what real socialism is, like true German socialism of the 19th century versus the what's, you know, the George Soros communism, which is masquerading as socialism of the present day.
Yeah, you know, that'd be a good topic for discussion sometime, because there are many different kinds of socialism. In South America, they have what's called Bolivarian socialism. And part of what that focuses on is making sure that, like, the necessities for life are kept at a low cost and they're subsidized. So food is kept at a low cost, and so is fuel and gasoline, because, you know, those are necessities for people to live. And also Bolivarian socialism also includes building houses for people of low income, helping them buy them and get them in a situation where they actually own a small piece of property with a little house on it.
Yeah, Simón Bolívar was a fascinating character and really, really did some good things for the people, populist hero.
Yeah, so that's an interesting topic we'll have to go into, because a lot of people just, you know, socialism with a broad brush and, you know, paint it with a broad brush, and it's a complex subject. So why don't we go on now? We're moving right along here, so let's hit the next clip.
But although Roosevelt, like the Nazis, was trying to organize society in a different way, unlike the Nazis, he believed that human beings were rational and could be trusted to take an active part in government. Roosevelt believed it was possible to explain his policies to ordinary Americans and take into account their opinions. To do this, he was helped by the new ideas of an American social scientist called George Gallup.
Favorite reading of New Deal Washington, the survey of U.S. public opinion. From offices at Princeton, New Jersey, a famed statistician, Dr. George Gallup, tells Washington from week to week what the nation is thinking. And in New York, Fortune magazine's analyst, Elmo Roper, compiles for publication a continuous record of the nation's approval or disapproval of how the country is being run.
Human beings were at the mercy of unconscious forces, and so needed to be controlled. Their system of opinion polling was based on the idea that people could be trusted to know what they wanted. They argued that one could measure and predict the opinions and behavior of the public if one asked strictly factual questions and avoided manipulating their emotions.
So enter George Gallup and the age of polling. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe?
A Gentile who actually respects these citizens as opposed to a deviant who treats them as cattle.
Wow, that's an interesting point. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, continue.
In 1936, Roosevelt stood for re-election. He promised further control over big business. To the corporations, it was the beginning of a dictatorship.
Roosevelt interferes with private enterprise and is running the country into debt for generations to come. Debt recovery is to let business alone.
But Roosevelt was triumphantly re-elected.
My friends, like a real landslide this time. So please let me thank you again and tell you that I hope to see you all very soon and bid you an affectionate good night.
Faced with this, business now decided to fight back, to regain power in America. At the heart of the battle would be Edward Bernays and the profession he had invented, public relations.
Following that election, business people start to get together and start to carry on discussions, primarily in private, and they start talking to each other about the need to sort of carry on ideological warfare against the New Deal and to sort of reassert the sort of connectedness between the idea of democracy on the one hand and the idea of privately owned business on the other. And so under the umbrella of an organization which still exists, which is called the National Association of Manufacturers, and whose membership included all of the major corporations of the United States, a campaign is launched explicitly designed to create emotional attachments between the public and big business. It's Bernays' techniques being used on a grand scale. I mean, totally.
General Motors' Parade of Progress, traveling the high roads and byroads of America, bringing to millions of Americans in their own hometown the fascinating story behind modern industry.
The campaign set out to show dramatically that it was business, not politicians, who had created modern America.
A better mode of living for all of us.
Bernays was an advisor to General Motors, but he was no longer alone. He had found it now flourished as hundreds of public relations advisors organized a vast campaign. They not only advertisements and billboards, but managed to insinuate their message into the editorial pages of the newspapers.
Okay, we're at the bottom of the hour here. We'll be right back with the final half hour. Okay, we're back here on Revolution Radio, Radio, Radio. And I'm here with Giuseppe, and we're talking about Century of the Self. And before the bottom of the hour break, it was sort of going into this conflict between, you know, the big business leaders of the day and Roosevelt. And there really was the perception, and it was partly true, that Roosevelt's organization, his administration, was teeming with communists. And there were quite a few people that actually were exposed as communists in the Roosevelt administration. And I guess this conflict between business and Roosevelt sort of culminated in this attempted coup by the DuPonts and other powerful industrials to overthrow Roosevelt, and using General Smedley Butler as sort of a front man, but he didn't go along with it. So a lot of things were happening at that time. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe?
Well, a key player in that attempted coup was George H.W. Bush's father, Prescott Bush, and who, because of the power he and some of the other traitors wielded, Roosevelt realized if he would execute them as the treasonous individuals they were, that would set off an internal civil war that might tear the country apart. So he got Prescott Bush to agree that none of his children in the future would ever participate in the federal government. So I guess, you know, Prescott Bush is clearly a man of his word.
Oh, yeah, right, right, yeah. Tell me another. Okay, why don't we play the next clip?
Oh, one quick thing, though, Scorpio, is...
Oh, go ahead, yeah.
Revolution Radio is 100% listener-supported, so shows like this where Scorpio put all his time into pulling these clips and creating this narrative of how history has shaped the modern dysfunctional world, he wasn't paid for that. And the back-end people who create the archives, they're not paid. Everybody donates their time to champion free speech, and Revolution Radio is the largest internet radio station on the planet dedicated solely to free speech. So if you could donate to Revolution Radio, if you go to the website freedomslips.com or revolution.radio, and across the top are various ways to donate, a cash donation. You can go to the Zazzle store and buy some awesome Revolution Radio swag, t-shirts, bags, whatever you want. They make it for you. Or even better, go to Patreon and sign up as an ongoing small monthly donator, and that will allow you access to the archives, which are for the summer have been free, but that's only going to go for about another couple weeks, and then you'll need a paid Patreon subscription to get into the archives. And we want to thank everybody who does donate each month. And where we left off on this clip, is the counteroffensive by the captains of industry to take back their rightful role as the leaders of society from Roosevelt and his technocrats and communists.
That warned of the unscrupulous manipulation of the press by big business. And the central villain was the new figure of the public relations man.
They tried to achieve their ends by working entirely behind the scenes, corrupting and deceiving the public. The aims of such groups may be either good or bad, so far as the public interest is concerned, but their methods are a grave danger to democratic institutions.
The films also showed how the responsible citizen could monitor the press themselves. They could create a chart that analyzed the reporting for signs of hidden bias. But such earnest instruction was to be no match for the powerful imagination of Edward Bernays. He was about to help create a vision of the utopia that free market capitalism would build in America if it was unleashed. In 1939, New York hosted the World's Fair. Edward Bernays was a central advisor. He insisted that the theme be the link between democracy and American business. At the heart of the fair was a giant white dome that Bernays named Democracy. And the central exhibit was a vast working model of America's future, constructed by the General Motors Corporation.
To my father, the World's Fair was an opportunity to keep the status quo, that is, capitalism, in a democracy. Democracy and capitalism, that marriage. Right, linking, like, just like that. He did that by manipulating people and getting them to think that you couldn't have real democracy in anything but a capitalist society, which was capable of doing anything, of creating these wonderful highways, of making, you know, moving pictures inside everybody's house, of telephones that didn't need cords, of sleek roadsters. I mean, it was consumerist, but at the same time, you inferred that in a funny way, democracy and capitalism went together.
The World's Fair was an extraordinary success and captured America's imagination. The vision it portrayed was of a new form of democracy in which business responded to people's innermost desires in a way politicians could never do. But it was a form of democracy that depended on treating people not as active citizens as Roosevelt did, but as passive consumers. Because this, Bernays believed, was the key to control in a mass democracy.
It's not that the people are in charge, but that the people's desires are in charge. The people are not in charge. The people exercise no decision-making power within this environment. So democracy is reduced from something which assumes an active citizenry to the idea of the public as passive consumers.
Oh!
Driven primarily by instinctual or unconscious desires, and that if you can in fact trigger those needs and desires, you can get what you want from them.
Okay, yeah, so just manipulate people through their own desires. What are your thoughts, Giuseppe?
How tragic. The people are not in charge. The people's desires are in charge. And once again, the archetypical seven deadly sins, lust, gluttony, greed, sloth, wrath, envy, pride, that's your typical American right now, your typical American consumer. And actually, it's your typical Western and almost global consumer now, because, you know, that whole message through the power of the mass media has infected the rest of the world too. It's a sad state. And I love it how the free market is championing free market capitalism, and There's never a free market. It's always controlled and monopolistically insured, right? There, it's all PR spin. Spin just is nothing more than lies. It's all lies to serve the
and half truths. Yeah,
right, right.
Well, and yeah. It's like, you know, we can have democracy, but we're really going to be in charge. Another illusion, you know, like there's a secret elite that are guiding the desires of humanity, but meanwhile, desires are going to lead the road. So you see multiple layers of deception with this kind of thinking.
Well, to take it back to hour one and your excellent introduction, right now the polling of the American citizenry is probably realistically barely 25% will take this coronavirus vaccine. And so right now, representatives of the government and Yale University are brainstorming what is the most effective way to change the minds of the consuming American. And should they shame people? Should they play upon their patriotic duty? Should they play upon their empathic heart to help others and get the vaccine? I mean, it never ends.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thought. And what I kind of see them doing right now is they're saying, well, we're on this race for a vaccine, and man, you got to have this vaccine or, you know, life will never get back to normal. But here's the thing. We don't know if there'll be enough doses for everybody. So there's a shortage, so you better get in line and get yours now.
Right, right. There you go. Yeah, and then what's coming, I've been saying this for months, and it's coming, is right around the flu season, they're going to introduce another more virulent form of their bioweapon. Remember, they're spending $500 billion a year just in the United States for this gain of function, and all of a sudden, it's going to kill somewhere between 100,000 and a million people, and all of a sudden, you're going to see lines 30 miles long with people in tents lined up like the Beatles came back from the dead to play a concert, people in lines were trying to get that vaccine. So it's coming. I'm predicting it. It's coming.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, you better get in line now because there is a shortage. Yeah, maybe we'll have designer vaccines too, you know?
Well, they're designer masks. Everybody's like, you know, doing that. In fact, the Zazzle store will print your own Revolution Radio mask or your own.
No, please don't. Not that.
I know.
But yeah, that's very interesting. And, you know, going back to the little preview I was talking about with this swine flu thing with this Dr. Morris back in 1976, he warned that any potential vaccine would be much more dangerous than the disease itself. And, of course, he was fired for that sort of thinking.
Well, it's played out exactly right. I mean, why in the world do you need a vaccine for such a benign disease, which nature intended everybody to have, called chickenpox? You get chickenpox at the same time you're with your parents and your grandparents, and they're exposed like a little booster so they don't get shingles. And now they've got this vaccine which is causing this massive outbreak of shingles in people as young as adolescents. Measles was another relatively benign disease. You'd have measles party. And now this measles, mumps, another benign disease, and rubella, you know, all of them in the most extreme circumstance can be deadly. But out of a million people, each one of those might kill 10, right? It's so not deadly that, but now you've got this MMR vaccine that has literally turned millions of innocent young people into zombies, the walking dead, autistic, just zombies. It's so criminal, so sad.
Yeah. It's interesting about vaccines. I think we're going to be in for a wild ride with that one. You know, Dashi in the chat has an interesting quote from Edward Bernays from his book, We are governed, our minds are molded, our tastes formed, our ideas suggested, largely by men we have never heard of. That is very cogent and, I think, quite accurate.
It's totally accurate. And what's interesting, it wasn't in the clips, but because we're down to our final clip, is that Edward Bernays' daughter really was brutally honest about her father, that she said he really hated people, and he would constantly call everyone stupid or dopes, and his own workers, he despised them, and his own family, he didn't treat us well. He was, you know, not the kind of guy you'd get to spend a time with and get a hug or anything. So it's like these deviants who get so arrogant and so powerful in their dark magics that they forget how to be human.
Oh, that's a good point. And I do think that clip is on there, but it's on part two, which we're not going to have time to get into today. And, you know, in part two, Anna Freud, you know, Sigmund Freud's youngest daughter, brought his theories to America in a very big way, and it exploded onto the scene in the 1950s and had a tremendous influence on American culture. And apparently she was also described as being very cold and not at all friendly. And so in a future episode, we'll have to get into that. But why don't we go ahead and play that last clip off, and then we'll discuss.
And in May 1938, Freud, his daughter Anna, and other members of his family set off for London. Freud arrived in London as Britain was preparing for war, and he settled with his daughter Anna in a house in Hampstead. But Freud's cancer was now far advanced, and in September 1939, just 3 weeks after the outbreak of war, he died. The Second World War would utterly transform the way governments saw democracy and the people they governed. Next week's program will show how the American government, as a result of the war, became as the worst savage, dangerous forces hidden inside all human beings, forces that needed to be controlled. The terrible evidence from the death camps seemed to show what happened when these forces were unleashed. And politicians and planners in post-war America would come to believe that hidden under the surface of their own population were the same dangerous forces. And they would turn to the Freud family to help control this enemy within. And ever adaptable, Edward Bernays would work not just for the American government, but the CIA. And Sigmund Freud's daughter, Anna, would also become powerful in the United States because she believed that people could be taught to control the irrational forces within them. Out of this would come vast government programs to manage the inner psychological life of the masses.
Let's hear a bit about Freud.
Yeah, so now we're starting to get into World War II and its after effects, and we're seeing that these ideas are metastasizing into the government and the CIA, and that we have to control the population because otherwise we'll end up with another Hitler in America.
Yes, indeed. And part two is really fascinating because Anna Freud is every bit the deviant her father was, but in different ways. And I don't want to reveal too much, but I will reveal who our featured guest is next week. She's a journalist and author, Susan Bradford, and she's written an amazing book recently, just released May 2020, called Unmasked, the Coronavirus Story. And it's the nauseating truth behind the global quest to bring the world to heel, destroy nationalism, undermine the Trump presidency through fake scandals, simulated pandemics, junk science, political puppets, brazen extortion, and rapacious money grabs. Now Susan will tell us next week how she really feels.
Rapacious money grabs. That sounds familiar to what we're talking about on this episode. It all sort of connects together. And you're correct. Anna Freud was quite the deviant herself. And just to give a small preview, because it'll be some time before we get into the next part, but she essentially broke up this marriage of this woman that she knew and had a lesbian affair with her and dragged her kids into psychoanalysis and really screwed them up real good. And it was an aspect that was very embarrassing for the Freud family, to say the least.
Oh, I know. The full story just shows what A is for Anna, A is for a-hole.
Yeah, yeah. And again, now they're talking about Bernays going into the CIA, and he goes on to, help engineer coups of various governments that, it came to be known as Operation Condor, essentially. But there had to be a propaganda aspect to that, too, to convince the American people that this is what we need to do to protect America. And so we're really just seeing, how our reality was constructed in the 20th century. It's really the implications of this documentary are profound.
Right. And he, within the constraints of being on the BBC, and he still manages to reveal a lot of the machinations. And you know, Bernays and all these other operatives were all operating at the same time. You know, it's not like Bernays was the only evil genius. It's really something. And it's sad because you look at the degeneration, the de-evolution, like that band Devo came up with in the 70s, the de-evolution of a once decent people and who could think, who worked hard and just bought what they needed. And if you passed high school in the teens, you really had to know your stuff. You give that, they used to have a national test to prove you deserve to pass, and you had to take it. And today you give that test to PhD candidates and they're not going to pass it. So that's the level of being dumbed down and turned into a feckless consumer, jumping from fad to fad and influenced by these vacuous celebrities to the celebrity will tell you who to vote for. It's like, who gives a goddamn what any celebrity has to say about anything? They're just paid circus animals.
Yeah, and what's interesting too, if going back to the genesis of this kind of thinking, which is essentially human beings are irrational and dangerous and they have to be controlled. Well, so they spent a whole century, more or less, working on better ways to control everybody. And then, the next logical step for this kind of thinking is just to say, you know what, there's too many people. We got to start killing people. We need to depopulate. And that's the doorstep that we're sitting upon right now, is that kind of thinking, the next logical conclusion from what Freud began in some ways.
Well, right. They want to destroy the white family unit who still works hard, who has made a decent middle class or upper working class life for themselves, and they're set. They've enraged these weak minded, weaponized minorities: the blacks, the lesbian, gay, LGBTQ, whatever other letters they're adding to it, and of course the dark wing, the satanic Talmudic wing of the Jewish population that is the masterminds behind it. So yeah, really the push is now to get the consumer, the feckless consumer, to you don't really care about America now, do you? We have to be in the North American Union, and you don't really care about having a job. We'll get you a card that will give you $2,000 a month. And as long as you're a good boy or girl, because we're tracking if you're vaccinated, we're tracking if you're being obedient to the dictates of the globalist government. And if you're a rebel in any way, we're going to turn off that card. and we're going to lock you out of the internet. And so obey, weak mind, obey. That's what's coming.
Yeah, and, you know, of course, they've targeted the black population for a long time, too, with, you know, a gangster rap and, of course, crack and the deliberate destruction of the black family unit as well. And now they're sort of using – they're trying to, you know, use this old technique to use the black community as a battering ram to sort of break things down further. And the atomization of different groups, you know, to make everybody hate each other so no one looks at the real cause of what's going on or how we got to where we are now.
Right. Divide and conquer so you never look at who governs, who's molding your mind, who's forming your taste, who's planting ideas, and largely by men we've never heard of who like to swing chickens over their heads.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we're at an interesting point in time right now because I think the future may very well be to people returning to saying, well, what do I actually need? Do I really want to spend my whole life trying to buy things that I don't really need that just, you know, don't make me happy anyway? And I think we're at a real turning point in human history right now. This is a very interesting time to be alive. And
right.
We're playing for very high stakes right now, make no mistake.
Well, one of the Revolution Radio hosts, Bruce McDonald in the Morning, he is a self-actualized fellow, and he came to the decision that he didn't like the way money controlled him, and he was a middle-class Canadian, and he sold it all off, and now he's living in Costa Rica and has spurned it all. So he's an early adopter. And I think, as you said in the first hour, we have to do that here in the United States to get, you know, local and have people growing organic. And if this insane digital-only currency occurs, you've got to create a barter system and work outside that system. It has to be the rights and freedoms of the individual, and people wake up. And I think a lot of that is coming, and it makes sense for that to occur.
It does make sense because you can't stop evolution forever. You can slow it down. You can cause a lot of trouble, but there is a grander plan at work, and there's also a zeitgeist behind the different ages of time, and I don't think any group of people can entirely control that. It's sort of written into the script on a larger level, so to speak. And we'll just have to see how this all plays out. I'd like to thank everyone for taking their time on this Saturday to listen in. And hopefully you got some insights about how this playing field that we're living in was created and what might be for us in the future. Okay, there's the guys. Thanks for coming on.
Great show.